Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
Good to see everybody here. We just got in 2 days ago, and nice to be back here on the western side of the hemisphere. But always when we are, we think about going back home to Israel, our homeland. Before I start today, I have a very exciting message I want to share with you. Maybe give a little bit of an update on a couple of things that we're doing in the Holy Land and how things are going there. I want to give your greetings from the brethren in Israel, our congregation there, and really nice people and nice things that are happening. I really think that we're at a major crossroad in life, in the world, in Israel, so many places. It's like almost like if you look at a main train station and so many trains coming in and they all come to the same spot, you know, that's the main spot. And I said, you know, it's amazing how, you know, we sit here and you got to go through your life every day. Things never happen. Sometimes people will write to me and they'll say about coming to Israel. And they'll say, well, what, do you think that I'm thinking of coming to the feast, but maybe there'll be war. And I'll say, well, there's been the threat of war since 1948. There's always the threat of war. It's never stopped. It never will stop till the kingdom comes. So, you know, if we did not host the feast because of the threat of war, we wouldn't have the feast. But praise the Heavenly Father that for the last 11 years, He has blessed us to be hosting the feast over there and doing some other things. This last year has been an amazing year for Yahweh's work over there. I've been blessed at least on 6 different occasions to be invited to the Knesset and to speak to the Knesset on our programs and what we're doing. The government is very happy with our Goodwill Ambassador for Israel program, where we're taking people from the nations and we're bringing them there. And in a 2-month program, the most extensive program you'll ever find anywhere in the world, that at the end of the 2 months, people are more equipped to know about Israel than regular Israelis that have lived there their whole life. It's amazing. We have Jewish agencies that put it together for us, and we have everything from lectures on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and then we'll have a panel discussion. A person will come from Peace Now. You'll get a person from the Yesher Council. Last year we had the blessing of having Benjamin Netanyahu's former chief of staff. You'll see him sometimes on even CNN, Naftali Bennett. A really good guy who heads the Yesher Council. And then they'll discuss, and the students can ask them questions and different things. And it's extremely interesting. Then the next week we'll go into the field and see for ourselves. We'll go to Bethlehem in the morning. You go into the houses of the Palestinian Christians that are living there, even the Muslims in Bethlehem. You get to see for yourself the situation. Then in the afternoon you go to the other side where they're bombing into Gush Etzion, the very first settlement ever in Israel. An amazing story. Because 3 times they tried to raise that settlement in Gush Etzion, and all 3 times they were attacked by Arabs and killed. The last time that it happened, before Israel was a nation, they killed everybody. Only the children were left that they took out of there before the massacre happened. And then, when after the Six-Day War, when Israel took back the West Bank, they said that is going to be the very first settlement. And it was started by the children of the people that were all killed. And you get to meet these children and share their story and actually get to see the bunker where they were left. And it's just amazing to hear firsthand, you know, of people that, like ourselves, some of us, that have given up everything because they believe in the promises of Yahweh, because they believe that there's a reason why Israel's a nation again after 2,500 years. So it really is an amazing program. We have the best speakers in Israel. We have the best lecturers, the best programs. We have a rabbi who comes and teaches us biblical Hebrew once a week. We learn all the roots from the Bible, and really, really interesting course. But they're very, very interested in it because it's bearing a lot of fruit. Last year, we happened to have a judge from Nicaragua that's there. You know, Nicaragua does not have relations anymore with Israel because they're communist. And this person was able to come and be part of the program, and just like that, you know, we also had this year, a daughter of a judge from the Philippines that are coming. And they see, like with King David's case, that one person can be like 10,000 others. Because when you come back and you're able to go to your local media and you're able to really be an ambassador for Israel, and that's what we are. You know, although technically, you know, we're ambassadors for the kingdom of Yahweh, You know, Yahweh's earthly kingdom is in Israel. You know, that's where Yeshua will reign for the 1,000 years in the millennium. So we've really been blessed. About maybe, I guess it was a month and a half ago. It was the day that the government came together, the new government that started there, that's now falling apart again. But I was invited to the Knesset that day and got to meet Prime Minister Netanyahu and some of the different people there from his office. And it's just been really, really good, some of the doors that the Father's been opening for us to be able to help the brethren around the world. You know, I was also named as an international director for bringing volunteers. So I have the opportunity now for helping people. You know, we have maybe about, I think we have 10 that are there and 4 more that are coming. But we're able to bring international volunteers that want to stay in Israel, and they can volunteer in hospitals, they can volunteer in nursing homes, all different opportunities that we have. And also, because we work with archaeology over there, they have asked us to help to man the dig. They have a dig going on in Magdala. Really, really interesting dig, because most digs in Israel, when you're digging, you'll take a spot of dirt, and maybe the size of a 10 by 10 square, and you go down and you'll get to the 7th century. And then you'll say, okay, is this important? It's not so important. So you'll categorize it, and then you'll go lower. And you keep going until you hit bedrock, and then you know there's nothing below there. In Magdala, it's one of the only digs in Israel that is only from early 1st century BC to early 1st century AD. There was never any other town that was there. So everything they're finding is very easy to date, because that's the only time period that the dating is there. And they found also in Magdala the harbor, the ancient harbor that was there. I got to hear the lecture at the Kinneret College on that. That's telling them what the water levels were like. Of course, you know, back in the early 1990s, or maybe even late 1980s, they found what they call the Jesus boat, Yeshua boat, of the first century, a wooden boat from the time of Yeshua and the apostles, in the very place that he says to Peter, you know, leave everything and come follow me. And 2,000 years later, they find this boat from that time period. Now, can I tell you that it was Peter's boat? No. There's no inscription that says Peter was here, you know. But, you know, when you're looking in faith, it is very interesting that they find a boat, 12 different types of wood, like 12 apostles, from the very time period. No doubt that it's from that time period. And my neighbor in Gennesar was the man who found it, you know, that found it over there. So we have the opportunity that if some people would like to come and participate in archaeological dig there, you know, even up to a year if you'd like to do it, that we can help with that we're going to help support and bring the people. And that would be a really, really interesting one, because in that dig already, they found the synagogue in Magdala. And in that synagogue, they found the oldest and most decorative menorah that they've ever found in Israel from the synagogue. So, and it's not a very big synagogue. There must be another one that's there also. But really neat that we know for sure this is the only synagogue in all of Israel that you know Yeshua would have been in there. You know, there is a synagogue in Capernaum. That's a 5th century synagogue built on a 4th century synagogue from a 2nd century synagogue. And we think it's from the 1st century synagogue. But you can't be 100% sure. But with holy places, they would always build one from the other. So you might want to think about it, just to share with you. We're also taping. We'll send this out. But also, if anybody is interested in coming with us for Sukkot, another great opportunity that you'll have over there in the land. We know Deuteronomy 16:16, 3 times in the land, all your males come to Jerusalem and appear before me. And this year, we're going to have a very interesting Sukkot. This message I'm giving is kind of a prelude to that. Some of the things that the heavenly signs that are happening. I wrote here, I don't know if you can see it, but I'll read it for you if you can't. But I really think it's going to be a really interesting year. For the last 6 months, the Father has really been impressing on me to start preparing the bride. And I can prove to you, still working on it, I don't have everything. Pray to the Father, I'll be ready for Sukkot. But there's proof that I'm finding that the bridegroom is ready to come out of his chamber. And it's exciting. It's exciting for me, and I think it'll be exciting for you. So, as the Father's putting this on my mind, back in January, I took a trip to the Philippines. We have about 54, 57 congregations there. Really, the work in the Philippines is going good. Wonderful brothers and sisters there. And this one sister in the Philippines that has a lot of businesses and different things. She's a really, really nice lady. She invited us to do a seminar at her place that she owns. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, she did this. She invited the ambassador for Israel, too, to the Philippines, and invited me, both of us as guests, over there. And we come in this room, and the next thing you know, all the ladies are coming in with wedding dresses on. And the ambassador, he's saying, whoa, what's going on here? I said, I don't know. They didn't tell me. And they were doing a ceremony of dedication. You know, and it really, like I said, everything over the last 6 months that's been coming is all about the bride. You know, keep coming back to the bride and coming back to the bride. Sometimes I can be hard-headed, but when the Father conks me about 5 or 6 times, then you know there's something He's trying to share with you. So we are dedicating this feast this year of Sukkot 2012 to the feast of the bride and the bridegroom. And we are also going to do a dedication ceremony for anybody who's there with us that would like to a rededication, because I'm telling you the time is short. And I'm not only telling you it, I can prove it to you. I could prove it to you. So only the Father knows what that means, but we're going to talk about it a little bit in here. Because sometimes when you're talking about the end times, what do you hear a lot of times? No man knows the day of the hour, right? It's not for us to know. We're not supposed to know. It could happen in 1,000 years. I'll prove to you it can't happen in 1,000 years. And I'm not going to tell you the day and the hour, because no man knows the day and the hour. But I can tell you the time frame. I can tell you the time frame. I mean, logically, think about it. 1/3 of the Bible is prophecy. 90% of those prophecies are for our time. The Father gets so specific with things. He says 1,260 days, 1,290 days. Wait for the 1,335 days. When you see the abomination of desolation, do this. When you see this, do that. Why would He take 1/3 of the Bible and tell us all these things if we are not supposed to know? And we're going to see. We're going to see there's a group of people that will know, and there's a group of people that won't know. And then you choose what group you want to be in, or you pray about what group you want to be in. But certainly we can know. So let's go to Mark 13. And this message is called Signs in the Heavens and the Star of Bethlehem. Because Yahweh works in the circular. You know, everything that's been, has been, and will be. So if we know the pattern, if you know the pattern of the Father, He doesn't change. So once you find the pattern to something, you know the pattern will be the same over and over and over again. That's why the year goes from equinox to equinox, as we'll see. The sun goes around the earth in a revolution. Could be a revelation, depending how you look at it. But Mark 13, verse 28... He says, and from the fig tree learn the parable. When its branch becomes tender and it puts out leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see these things happening, know that it is near at the door. So He tells us, watch the parable of the fig tree. Now what's interesting about the fig tree, the only tree in the world, that the leaves and the fruit come out at the same time. Because usually, right, you plant a tree and what happens? Put in a seed. First you get this little stick that comes up, then you get some greenery and some leaves, then you get a little green piece of thing that is going to develop into something. But a fig tree doesn't happen that way. A fig tree, all of a sudden the leaf and the fruit all come quickly and very early. You know, it's called the pagay, the early fig that comes there. So He's telling us that this isn't going to be over hundreds and hundreds of years in the end time. And we know for sure, He said, this generation will not pass all these things happen. So we know that once you're in the last generation, it's not going to be hundreds of years. It's not like the Daniel prophecy that was over, you know, 490 years. That once you know the generation, then you're going to know the time frame. And I'm going to show you right in the Bible exactly that generation. So if you drop down to verse 35, He says, then you watch, for you do not know when the master of the house is coming, at evening or midnight or cockcrowing or morning, so that He may not come suddenly and find you sleeping. And what I say to you, I say to all, watch. Watch. So I'm going to tell you a lot today about watching, because we're going to read it. That's what we're told to do. We're told to watch. But watch what? That's what we're going to see. So again, only the Father knows the day and the hour, right? But He tells us to watch for the closeness of the time. You know, so again, we don't have to know the exact day and hour. You know, and if you ever studied the ancient ceremony of the wedding in ancient Israel, It's a real interesting ceremony. Because what happens is the bridegroom will come to the father of the bride and he'll say, I'd like to marry your daughter. And then they make a contract together. They sign that contract. And then what happens? The bridegroom leaves and he goes out and he prepares for his new wife. And that preparing takes about a year. Building a house, getting everything ready, getting set. And you don't know. It could be 10 months, it could be 12 months, it could be 13 months. He doesn't know the exact time frame, but you know around the time frame. And then what happens, there's somebody in the town who's watching for when the bridegroom is coming. And what happens is they keep the lights, the bride will keep her light burning outside that house. So when the bridegroom comes in the night, where he sees the brightest light, he knows that's where his bride is. And as he comes riding in, the person who's watching will say, the bridegroom cometh, the bridegroom cometh. And then they prepare for the wedding. So he's telling us the same thing. We know that our master went to heaven. We know that he gave us a general time frame. We know that he says a thousand years is a day, and a day is as a thousand years. We know in 6 days the world was created, the 7th day is the Sabbath. And we know that the Father gave 6,000 years to man, and the 7,000 year is the millennium of Yeshua. And we know we're very close to that 6,000 year. So again, we don't need to know the day and the hour. We know we're in the time frame. And anybody that tells you, oh, there could be 100 years, there could be 1,000 years, you know what you tell them? Get thee behind me, Satan. Because that's what he wants you to do. He wants you to doubt and he wants you to sleep. Because if you do, you're never going to know. When I used to read these scriptures, I wonder, you know, how on earth can he come at a time I don't expect him? I'm always expecting him. Because Satan can deceive us into thinking he's going to delay his coming. And to a degree, he has delayed. I mean, people have been expecting him the last 2,000 years and he's not here yet. But now we could show proof that he's on his way. Because he's giving us signs to watch for the closeness of the time. Luke 21 in verse 34. He says, but beware in yourself that your hearts never become heavy by extravagance and by drunkenness and by distress of the world, and that they should come suddenly upon you. That's the biggest problem here in Babylon. It's the cares of life. And they do weigh you down. I mean, it happens to all of us. But if you let it weigh you down to a point where you stop watching, that day's going to come on you. It's going to come very, very suddenly. You've probably heard the expression, like a thief in the night, right? Do you know what that means? Thief in the night. In ancient Israel, what would happen is the high priest before the holy day, he would have to stay up all night inside the sanctuary or the temple watching. And what would happen is he even had a boy attendant that would be with him. And the floor of the sanctuary, which was stone, was cold. So he wouldn't even wear shoes to stay up. And if he fell asleep, the boy was supposed to wake him up. Because what would happen is the high priest would come in the night, and if he caught the priest that was on duty sleeping, you know what he would do? He would literally burn his garment. And then the next day, when all the priests would come with their priestly garments, he wouldn't have his. And everybody would know that he was sleeping during his watch. And that's what it's talking about when it says Yeshua comes as a thief in the night. Not the rapture. You know, that's why I say, the reason why people in the world are missing it is they're looking for the wrong signs. Never talks about a rapture in Scripture. It talks about watching certain things that we're going to talk about. So Luke 21:34. You know, the stress of the world, verse 35, as a snare, for it will come on all those sitting on the face of all the earth. It's going to come as a snare. I think we're starting to see that. Then be watchful at every time, begging that you be accounted worthy to escape all these things, the things being about to happen, and to stand before the Son of Man. Some translations put that pray at all times. If you look in the Bible, you'll find that there's many different words for prayer. So we tried to be as specific as possible. This word for prayer literally is to beg, you know, to petition and beg the Father, to be begging him to be accounted worthy to escape all the things about to happen and stand before the Son of Man. So again, we're to watch for something to see the closeness of the time. Luke 12, go back a few chapters there. Luke 12 and verse 36. And you be like men awaiting their master when he returns from the wedding ceremony. Just like we talked about, the bridegroom cometh. So that he coming and knocking they will at once open to him. Blessed are those slaves whom the master will find when he comes to be awake. Truly I say to you that he will gird himself and will make them recline, and coming up he will serve them. And if he comes in the second watch, or he comes in the third watch, and he finds it so, blessed are those slaves. But know this, that if the housemaster had known the hour the thief was coming, he would have watched and would not have allowed his house to be dug through. And you then be ready, for in the moment you don't expect it, the Son of Man comes. In the moment you don't expect it, the Son of Man comes. Why would that be? Because they're not watching. If you're watching, he's never going to come in a moment you're not expecting him. Because you'll always be expecting him. Because you'll be watching for the signs. You have to watch for the signs. Daniel 12, 9 and 10. Daniel 12, 9 and 10. And he said, go, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed until the end time. Many shall be purified and made white and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly. And not one of the wicked will understand, but the wise shall discern and understand. So you're starting to get the picture. Only the wise will understand. Only the wise will understand. Why? Because the wise are watching. See, Yeshua said, an evil and adulterous generation look for a sign, and none will be given. Now, there's a difference between Yahweh's signs that he gives you and signs and wonders. And that's what people really want. They want to see a miracle. They want to see signs and wonders. And the people that are looking for signs and wonders, you know where they're going to get it from? The Anti-Messiah. Because the Anti-Messiah does a lot of signs and wonders. But for the people that are looking for the oath, that's the Hebrew word for sign, the people that are looking for the oath of Yahweh, they got to watch. They got to watch because not everybody is going to see it. But it's something that if you're wise, you're going to be able to discern. So you have to be watching. The first sign he gave us, what do we say? Watch the fig tree. Who is the fig tree? Israel. Israel is the fig tree. Jeremiah 24, Joel 2, we know a shadow of a doubt, Israel is the fig tree. If you go to Isaiah 66, in verse 8, it says, who has heard such a thing? Who has seen things like this? Shall the earth be brought forth in one day? Shall a nation be born in one step? For Zion travailed and also brought forth her sons. So the first thing to watch for, the thing to know that we're entering this generation, is Israel being a nation again. And it's interesting, if you read commentaries, Christian commentaries like Adam Clark and some of these from the late 1800s, even the 1700s, they'll all tell you all the 100-and-something scriptures that talks about Israel being a nation again. It's all spiritual. Well, that's talking about the church. Well, that's talking about this. It's like, no. When Yahweh says something, he means it. He has 120, 130 scriptures claiming that Israel will be a nation again in the end time, and he means it. And here we are, 1948, May 14th, one day. Can a nation be brought forth in one day? Yes, it can. Hebrew, a dead language. The only dead language ever to be revived again. And talked about in Zephaniah. I will give them in that day a pure language. Very, very interesting. In that one verse in Zephaniah, in Hebrew you have 22 letters, and you have five what's called ensophit. That if that letter comes at the end of a word, its character looks different. In that one scripture that says, I will give them a pure language in that day, every single 27 letters is in that scripture. Yahweh's prophecy. It's amazing. It's amazing what you find in this book if you're watching and if you're looking for it. So Yahweh said, that's what Yeshua told us. Watch the fig tree. Leviticus 26 tells us, not going to go there, but verse 18, if you want to go there, you're welcome to, talks about once they come into the land, if you're not faithful, I will punish you seven times. Mentions it four or five times in Leviticus 26. Seven times duration, seven times duration. We know that a biblical year is 360 days. And we know that from Numbers 14:34, that Yahweh says your punishment will be a day for a year. A day for a year. Many times in the Bible it's used that way. Like we said, sometimes even a day is as 1,000 years. But we use that a day for a year principle. If you take 360 days, you times it by seven, you come up with 2,520 years. That's the duration of Israel's punishment. Israel goes into punishment, 573 BC, exactly 2,520 years later, to the day, 1948, they're a nation. So in 1932, when people are writing and saying, well, this is spiritual, or this is talking about the church, they weren't watching and they weren't reading the scriptures. Yahweh clearly says, and I got many, many messages on this. Unfortunately, today is not the message to talk about Israel being a nation again and all the prophecies and the importance of it. But we have many messages online on that. But I want to show you, if we're talking about watching, that was the first thing we had to watch. Really, really interesting. 1945, at the end of World War II, the beginning of this global end time, whatever you want to call it, generation. You had the International Monetary Fund. You had the United Nations. You had the world. All these things started in 1945. And then, poof, 1948, out of nowhere, Israel becomes a nation again. So what happens? What does it say also in the Bible when that happens? Let's go to Psalm 102. Because Psalm 102 is an amazing psalm that prophesied not only about the Holocaust, but about Israel being a nation again in the very time we're living in. Psalm 102, a prayer of the afflicted. When he is faint and pours out his complaint before Yahweh, hear my prayer, Psalm 102, O Yahweh, and let my cry come to you. Do not hide your face from me in the day of my trouble. Bow down your ear to me in the day I call. Answer me quickly. For my days are finished in smoke, and my bones are burned like a hearth. Crematoriums. My days are finished in smoke, my bones are burned like a hearth. People literally being burned in the Holocaust. My heart is stricken and dried like grass, so that I forget to eat my bread. Because of the voice of my sighing, my bones cleave to my flesh. You can go there to the Holocaust Museum. You cannot tell if it's a male or a female. All you see is flesh and bone. I mean, human beings that are adults that weighed maybe 50, 60 pounds. Unbelievable. Because of the voice of my sighing, my bones cleave to my flesh. I am like a pelican of the wilderness. I am like an owl of the desert. You know, where do they go? They're becoming extinct. I watch and I am like a sparrow alone on the housetop. My enemies curse me all the day long. My very name has been used as a curse against me. Why did they do it? Why did they kill 6 million Jewish people, 1.5 million children? If you go to the Holocaust Museum, they have a children museum there. That when you walk in, you have to hold on to the rail because it's always dark and there's stars up. And 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, they announce the names of those 1.5 million children that never had life, never had an opportunity. And they constantly just name it and name it and name it. And why? Why? Why did they make them wear yellow armbands for nothing else because they were Jewish? My enemies curse me all the day long. My very name has been used as a curse against me. For I have eaten ashes like bread and have mixed my drink with weeping. Some of the people, when their relatives would be burned in the crematoriums, literally as the wind would blow, the ash would come and the ashes of their very families would be blown right in their faces. Because of your anger and your wrath, for you have lifted me and cast me down. My days are like a shadow stretched out, and I wither like grass. Very poetic. But you, O Yahweh, shall dwell forever in your memory to generation and generation. You shall arise, have mercy on Zion, for the time to pity her. Yea, the appointed time has come. That word is Moed, the same word used for Holy Day. So again, I've had the blessing of speaking with young soldiers that were atheists. And they said, I could never believe in an Elohim that would allow the Holocaust to happen. And I said, do you know how you dishonor your grandparents' memory by doing that? As horrible as it was, as horrible as it is for 6 million people to die, I believe that every single one of those person would have done it if they knew that their grandchildren could have a homeland. If they knew that their death was not for nothing, but just the same way as our relatives fought in World War I and World War II to give us freedom. That literally out of the Holocaust, a nation was born. And today, they have a homeland. But there was an appointed time. There was a specific time. Exactly 2,520 years. At the appointed time, it has come. For your servants take pleasure in its stone and pity its dust. Archaeology. Archaeology is only a science of maybe 140 years. You know, in ancient times, they never thought of digging dirt and working with stones. But here it is, exactly what they started to do as soon as they came back to the land. For your servants take pleasure in its stones and pity its dust. So nations shall fear the name of Yahweh and all the kings, the earth, your glory. When Yahweh builds up Zion, he will appear in his glory. There you have it. When is he coming? That generation will not pass until all these things happen. Verse 18. This shall be written for the last generation, and the people be created shall praise Yahweh. Now again, there's not many Holocaust survivors left. But clearly he says, the people who saw the Holocaust, who went through the Holocaust, will see the Messiah appear. It's there. It's got to happen. And then it's how many? I don't know. You had two that entered the promised land, Joshua and Caleb. You know, you only had two. But clearly Yahweh says, when Zion is rebuilt, the Messiah appears, and this is written for the last generation. There's more than a million people now in Jerusalem. It's as big as it's ever been in its history. Zion is flourishing. The word, do you believe it or not? And like it says in Jeremiah, unless you believe, you will not be established. But sign number one, like I said, to many people in the world, they hate Israel. They can't stand Israel. Somebody was just telling me they were handing out a bookmarker we had. And they said, oh, what's that on the back? He said, it's Jerusalem. The guy threw it at him. I don't want it. But I can tell you one thing, that kind of attitude will not be in the kingdom of Yahweh. So sign number one. And this is now, we're 64 years down the line. So this isn't a sign that's just starting. This is a sign that's showing us we're coming to the end. We're coming to the end of one generation and the beginning of a new generation. But clearly we see, sign number one, the fig tree. This generation will not pass, and we know. Daniel 12 and verse 4. Daniel 12 and verse 4. But you, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book to the end time. Many shall travel to, many will travel back and forth, and knowledge will be increased. People say, oh, that could be any time. Oh, really? How many time periods have we had a knowledge explosion like we have today? Never. People will run to and fro, Daniel 12 and verse 4. People will run to and back and forth, and knowledge will be increased. So again, another sign of the end time. Like I said, isn't it amazing that I can be in Israel 1 minute, and in the same day, 12, 13, 14 hours later, I could be around the other side of the world. You know, first generation that we were ever able to do something like that. And like we said, definitely we see the knowledge, good and bad knowledge, being increased. We see Bible knowledge being increased, but other knowledge also. So another sign we're looking for, clearly our generation. Luke 21. Luke 21 gives us some other signs. Luke 21 and verse 7. And they asked him, saying, Teacher, then when will these things be? And what will be the sign when these things are about to happen? Pretty good question. And he's going to give the answer. And he said, Watch that you not be deceived. For many will come on my name saying, I am the Messiah. Also the time has come. Do not go after them. So deception, you know. Is there more deception? We were talking about that yesterday a little bit. You know, has the internet and all this more knowledge, you would think before it happened, you know, 30 years ago, if somebody said in 30 years, there's going to be internet and you'll be able to check everything out. And whenever someone gives a fact, you can immediately go online and check it. If you were to take a survey and say, will that make the congregation stronger and have less false doctrine and be better? They'll say, oh, of course. And it's the total opposite. It's brought in every chaos you can imagine. So he's saying, the first thing he's saying for is watch for deception. In verse 9, and when you hear of wars and revolutions, do not have fear, for they are necessary first to happen, but the end is not yet. We've been seeing it the last few years. You're seeing now in the Middle East, you're seeing in Tunisia, you're seeing in Egypt, you're seeing in Libya, you're seeing in Syria. And he's saying, don't, you know, it's going to happen, but the end is not yet. So don't panic yet that we're seeing these things. There's still other things that have to happen. And then he said to them, nation will be lifted up against nation and kingdom against kingdom. Unfortunately, we're getting close to that point, world war. And there will be severe earthquakes from place to place. We've been seeing some of them. And famines and plagues. I was just reading an article yesterday that they're saying that what's happening in America now, that this drought in the southern part of our country, I think it's in 26 or 28 states, that it's the worst natural disaster in the history of our country. And you know how much food that we create that we give to other people. So I'm not saying that Americans are not going to have food tomorrow, but maybe the Africans and the Asians won't, because we're not going to have enough to give out there. So we're seeing these things, earthquakes and famines and plagues, and there will be fears and terrorist acts, and great signs will be seen from heaven. That's the one we're going to get into. And the winters will be severe. You know, global warming, right? Whether you want to say it, the hot summers or the cold winters, you're seeing it. It's something. Whether it's global warming or it's Yahweh's, you know, prediction coming true, it's here. It's here. But all these things that we're reading about would happen, we're seeing these signs that are here. But I want to talk about one specific sign. I want to talk about the sign that he said, the signs in the heavens. Because again, when we're talking about famine and you're talking about earthquake and you're talking about war, you know, even if it's really bad, people can say, hey, there's always been that stuff. You know, that doesn't do anything. But the signs in the heavens are specific. The signs in the heavens are very specific. Go down to verse 22. Verse 22 of Luke 21. He says, for these are the days of vengeance, when all things that have been written are to be fulfilled. Drop down to verse 25. And there will be signs in the sun and the moon and the stars. And on the earth will be anxiety of nations with bewilderment, roaring of sea and surf, tsunamis, we see that kind of stuff. Men fainting from fear in expectation of the things coming on the earth, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Verse 28. But when these things begin to happen, have courage and look up and lift up your heads, because your salvation draws near. What did we say before? Watch. Watch. Where are you watching? Lift up your heads. Take a look. You're watching the signs in the heavens. You're watching the signs in the heavens, because the signs in the heavens can't be manipulated by man. They simply can't. And even earthquakes. I mean, they have things like HAARP. They have these other things. And you don't know. There could be a great earthquake. And was it man-made? Or was it something that came from Yahweh? But the one thing man cannot do is man can't manipulate the heavens. So if Yahweh is doing something in the sun and the moon and the stars, it's impossible for man to manipulate. So I have some amazing things that will be happening this Sukkot that I cannot share with you today, unfortunately. But what I want to do is I want to share with you today about the Star of Bethlehem, something that already happened that we know for sure exactly what it is. There's no ambiguity anymore since the age of computers that we know exactly what it is. And a matter of fact, I'm going to read a little bit from this book here. If you have ever seen it, it's called The Story That Astonished the World by Ernest Martin. And Ernest Martin wrote this book not as a religious book, but as just a factual book on the movement and the rotation. Because when you look at the sun and the moon and the constellations, they have a rotation. They have a rotation that goes around. So the same way that we don't have to guess how many hours are in every day, we know within 24 hours the sun will revolve around the earth. You know that it'll be a day. The sun rises and the sun sets. And you don't have to guess that. So the same way now with computer programs, you can go to any time in history and you can see exactly what the heavens look like. So without a shadow of a doubt, they know exactly what the Star of Bethlehem was. There's no ambiguity. And a matter of fact, 500 planetariums around the world have changed the date of December 25th to the conclusions that Martin came to his book. Because there was no signs in the heavens on December 25th in the year Yeshua was born. But when he was born, there was amazing signs in the heavens. So these are the players here. Jupiter, the king's planet. Venus, which is called the morning star. We know from Revelation 22:16, who's the morning star? Yeshua. You have Regulus. Regulus is the brightest star, the king's star, so to speak. And then the constellation of the Lion of Judah and the constellation of Bethula. Some people call it Virgo, but it's Bethula is the Hebrew name called the Virgin. Before I get into that, I want to clearly show you, though, from Scripture that all of this is in the Scriptures. You know, sometimes because paganism has taken the constellations and taken things and manipulated it, sometimes people are really afraid of it. But I want to clearly show you that all this stuff is in Scripture, and this is exactly what Yeshua was telling us when he told us to look for these things. Joel 2 and verse 31. Joel 2 and verse 31. Another sign in the end of the heavens, it says, the sun will be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the coming and great and awesome day of Yahweh. The sun will be darkened and the moon to blood. What is he talking about? Eclipse. Eclipse. What happens during a lunar eclipse? The moon is darkened. What happens during a solar eclipse? So clearly he's talking about eclipses that's happening here, signs in the heavens. And again, if you look anciently, whether you're talking about ancient Judaism with the rabbis, or you're talking about in the ancient world, going back to Egypt and every society, people knew the signs in the heavens. A matter of fact, why does almost every society have a seven-day week? Why is that being universal? Because of the signs of the heavens. Because of the sun and the moon and the five main planets. You know, with Jupiter, Venus, Mercury, Saturn. And that's the days of the week. Sunday is from the sun. Monday is from the moon. Every day that we have today, it's not the day in the Bible. In the Bible, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and Shabbat. But that's why you have a seven-day week, because you have five main planets, and then you have the sun and the moon. And by the rotation of these things, Yahweh tells us the story in the heavens. So Joel 2 clearly is talking about eclipses. I have another message called The Sun Will Be Turned to Blood, if you want to listen to it online. But in 2014 and 2015, there's a very, very rare tritad of four eclipses that are happening at Pesach Sukkot in 2014 and Pesach Sukkot 2015. This alliance that happens that way has only happened, I think, three times in the last 500 years. It happened in 1492, right before the Jews were expelled from Spain. It happened in 1948-49, when Israel became a nation. And it happened in 1967-68, when Israel took over the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. It's going to happen again in 2014 and 15, and then it won't happen for at least a century. So again, you watch. Not predicting, I'm just watching. I'm watching because he said to watch. He said the sun will be turned to blood, and the moon will be darkened before the great and terrible day of Yahweh. And that's exactly what an eclipse does. So that's what we're watching for. But I don't want to talk about eclipses today. I want to talk about something more amazing. Let's go to Genesis 1 in verse 14. Genesis 1 and verse 14. And Elohim said, let light sources be in the expanse of the heavens to divide between the day and the night. And let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. Anybody see anything about barley in there? I don't. Although you do need barley for your count to Shavuot, there's nothing about barley to make your year. And if you just follow this scripture, like it says, that the sun and the moon and the constellations are for seasons and days and years. And years. So if you simply let the sun travel around the earth and go through what's called the Tekufa, the equinox, you will always have ripe barley. You know, it's a moot point. So there's nothing ever in the Bible that tells us we are to create our calendar based on barley. Because Israel's only been a nation since 1443 BC. What did they do before that? When they weren't in the land and they weren't cultivating barley there. Because the barley you cultivate in Egypt is much different than the barley you cultivate in Israel. A matter of fact, in Israel, the barley in the Jordan Valley will be ready at least 6 weeks before the barley all the way up north, where the tribe of Dan is from. So it's really a moot point if you just simply follow the scriptures. And he tells us here, it will be for signs, the word oath. What did he say? There'll be signs in the heavens. So what are we watching for? We're watching for the sun and the moon and the constellations. In Hebrew, it's called the Maseroth. Zodiac is pagan, but Maseroth isn't. I'll show you. It's right in the Bible. It talks about it here. So there's sun, there's moons, and constellations. The sun goes through every 30 days. It goes through another constellation. It's called the precession of the equinoxes. And within 1 year, it will go through the 12 constellations and come back to start. Right around the same times of the equinox. And then your year can start. Your 1 year is over, the new year starts. Josephus wrote about it. He said, now that the sun was in Aries, the new year can start. So this is not something that is new. You know, this is something that in ancient times they understood it. And they used it for calculating their time. Like I said, the 7-day week comes from this. There's 12 constellations that are around the ecliptic circle. That's where you get the Maseroth from. Altogether, there's not millions of constellations. There's 48 constellations. And every one of those 12 constellations, there's two others. So there's 48 constellations altogether. But the 12 most important, what the Bible calls the Maseroth, are the 12 constellations that are around the ecliptical circle where the sun goes through. And amazingly enough, there's a couple of good books. One was written by E.G. Bullinger in the 1800s called The Gospel and the Stars. And it's amazing because those 12 constellations tell the whole good news message from the beginning of time. From creation, the good news message is in there in the 12 constellations. Again, I don't have the time for that today because I want to specifically get into the Star of Bethlehem and show you that. But it's good for learning for later. The sun travels through each of these constellations, like I said, about every 30 days, and they tell the good news message. It's interesting enough, each one of those constellations, there's 12 tribes of Israel, there's 12 constellations. Each constellation's from ancient times. Every tribe had a constellation to it. And when you look at the tribes, they all have a banner. That's where the banners come from. And a matter of fact, if you look how Moses set up the tabernacle, and he set the tribes around the tabernacle, it's from the Maseroth. That's the way the tribes were set up, from the Maseroth. And that the four major parts of the Maseroth, you know, you look at the lion, you know, you're looking at the ox, those are from the tribes of Israel. You have the three in the south, you have the three in the east, the three in the north, and the three in the west. It all comes from there. So we're seeing that this goes back way before the time of Moses. Let's go to Genesis 37. See, going all the way back to the time of Joseph. Genesis 37, verse 9. This is Joseph's dream. It says, "And he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers. And he said, Behold, I have dreamed another dream. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing themselves to me. And he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall we indeed come to bow ourselves to the earth to you? I and your mother and your brothers? And his father and his brothers envied him. But his father was attentive to the word." Attentive to the word. Talking about the constellations here. And again, Joseph being a type of the Messiah. If you look in the rabbinical ancient writings, they talk about two messiahs, Messiah ben Yosef, Messiah ben David. First, Messiah ben Yosef has to come, the suffering Messiah. And then once he dies, Messiah ben David comes and resurrects him. They just didn't get the point that it's the same person. But they got the concept right. You know, the suffering Messiah and the kingly Messiah, the priest and the king. The two being put into one. Let's go to the book of Job. If you look at the word for star and the word for planet in Hebrew, it's the same word. Kokav, they use the same word. So as we get into the Star of Bethlehem, we will see that actually it was a planet more than a star. But the book of Job, 9:6. Job 9:6. "Who shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble? The one speaking to the sun, and it does not rise, and he sets a seal around the stars, stretching out the heavens by himself and walking on the waves of the sea. Who made the bear, Orion, and Pleiades in the chamber of the south?" This is all talking about the constellations. These are constellations that are part of the Maseroth. The Maseroth that talks about that literal word that's used here in Job. Job 38 in verse 31. Job 38 and verse 31. He says, "Can you bind the bands of the Pleiades? Or loosen the cords of Orion? Can you bring out the constellations in their seasons?" The Maseroth, that's the word that's used there. "Or can we guide the bear with its sons? Do you know the limits of the heavens? Can you establish their rulership on the earth?" So Job, which is thought to be the oldest book of the Bible, definitely it goes back to the time of Abraham. We know it. It doesn't talk about the nation of Israel. doesn't talk about any kings at that time. When they're dealing with money, they're dealing with trading in silver, the same way they did in Abraham's time. So there's many things that show us that the book of Job is the oldest book of the Bible, and here it is. Back then, they're still going into these signs of the heavens that come that way. The Pleiades, the seven-star constellation. In Hebrew, it's called Kirmah. Kirmah, and it comes from the root word kames, and it literally means to store away a jewel. To hide away a jewel, and that's what Yahweh was doing. When he created the sun and the moons and the constellations, he hid this wonderful jewel of the plan of salvation up there. But if you know what to watch for, you can take that jewel out and see it for yourself. Let's go to Psalm 19. Psalm 19. To the chief musician, a psalm of David. The heavens are recording the glory of Yah, and the work of his hands, the expanse is manifesting. Day by day they pour forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. Do constellations actually speak? They're not physically speaking, but they're speaking in the plan that they're telling. They're speaking in the plan of salvation. Day by day they pour forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words where their voice is not heard. Because everywhere in the world, you see it, all around the earth, you see the Maseroth telling Yahweh's great plan of salvation. Their measuring line is gone out throughout all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them he has set up a tent for the sun. Like we said, the sun goes through a different constellation every 30 days. And when it comes back to the first, that's a new year. Clearly, there's nothing about barley in here. And he comes forth like a bridegroom from his canopy. Important scripture. He rejoices like a hero to run a race. His going forth from the end of the heavens and his orbit to the ends, and nothing is hidden from his heat. So he's poetically telling us what a beautiful plan of salvation that Yahweh has set for us through the signs in the heavens. Romans 10. Romans 10 is very interesting. Verse 13. Romans 10 and verse 13. He says, "For everyone whoever may call on the name of Yahweh will be saved." That comes from Joel in end time scripture. "How then may they call on the one whom they have not believed? And how may they believe one whom they have not heard? And how may they hear without a preacher? And how may they preach if they are not sent? Even as it has been written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach good news of peace, of those preaching good things. But not all obeyed the good news. For Isaiah says, 'Yahweh, who has believed our report?' Then faith comes by hearing, and hearing through the word of Yahweh. But I say, have they not heard? Yes, rather into all the earth their voice went out, and to the ends of the world their words." I just read this from Psalm 19. That he's saying, you know, how could they hear without a preacher? Because through the constellations, through the Maseroth, Yahweh has given all throughout the world. But they need someone to come and explain it. They need someone to come and share what they're seeing every single day of their life. At the birth of the Messiah, there were amazing signs in the heavens for 18 months. If we can understand these signs, we can understand the end times. Because again, it's the same pattern that we're seeing. So let's go to Matthew 2. Because first we want to look at these people called the wise men. Because remember what we read in Daniel? The wise will understand, but the wicked will not understand. So all of a sudden now in Matthew, you have these people popping out of nowhere, coming from the east, and they're called wise men. Magi. Matthew 2 and verse 1. "And when Yeshua had been born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, Magi arrived from the east to Jerusalem, saying, 'Where is he born, king of the Jews? For we saw his star.'" We saw his star in the east. That literally is in the Aramaic or the Hebrew, in the rising. They saw his star rising up from the east. "And we have come to worship him." So, we're not getting the rest of the picture, but we're going to fill in the blanks here in a minute or two. But these people, these magi, these people that are astrologers, these people that spend their whole life watching what we just talked about here, watching the constellations, watching the movement of them, They saw something, not just over one night, I'll prove it to you here. They saw something going on for 18 months, and then a crescendo to it, that they said, wow, this is it. This is what we've been waiting for. And it was enough for them to travel from the east, from Persia, all the way over here to Jerusalem, to Herod, to say, hey, we came to find the King of the Jews. And having heard all the chief priests and the scribes of the people, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. And they sent him in Bethlehem of Judea, so it had been written by the prophet. We know that's in Micah. Read it here. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judea, in no way are you least among the governors of Judah, for out of you shall come out one ruling who shall shepherd my people Israel. Coming from Micah 5:2. Then secretly calling the Magi, Herod asked of them exactly the time of the star appearing. In sending them to Bethlehem, he said, having gone exactly inquire about the child. And when you find him, bring me word again, so that coming, I may also worship him. And having heard the king, they departed, and behold, the star, like I said, that word can be a star or planet, which they saw in the east, went before them until it had come and stood over where the child was. And seeing the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. Important to know for that time, you know, because it's a prophetic sign of the Messiah being born. As we're going to see, that things were talked about this particular star before he was even born. But important for the end time. Because we see the same pattern repeating itself. So who were these wise men? Who were these wise men? I'll read just a little bit here from Martin's book. That he says, there is a considerable amount of early information about the Magi of the East. We are told by Herodotus, he's a historian, that they were originally one of the six tribes of the Medes, they came from Persia, a priestly caste similar to the Levites among the Israelites. In their early history, their occupation was to provide the kings of the Medes, Persians, and Babylonians with what they considered to be divine information about the daily matters involving government affairs. Because of the high religious and political esteem accorded them by the people of the East, they were able in the 6th century BC even to overturn some royal powers. So, and again, what you see on your little Christmas cards with three guys coming, you know, that's not the way it was. Because these guys were powerful, related to like kings, and the fact that there were three gifts given, people think there's three wise men. But the fact that when they got there that Herod was all nervous, you know, they could have had an entourage of 500 people with them, certainly. So the fact that there were three gifts doesn't mean how many. And it doesn't tell us how many, but there were certainly more than three there. So interesting enough, they were these magi coming there. Let's go to Daniel 4. Because how would they know? How would they know about the Messiah of Israel? How would they know that a king was going to be born? And how would they know through generation to generation to be looking for something specific to know when this would happen? Daniel 4 in verse 8. He says, but at last Daniel came in before me, whose name was Belteshazzar. Belteshazzar was Daniel's name given to him by Nebuchadnezzar. He says, according to the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy Elohim. And I told the dream before him, O Belteshazzar, master of the magicians, master of the magi, Daniel, because I know that the spirit of the holy Elohim is in you, and no secret baffles you, tell me the visions of the dream that I have seen and its meaning. Go to Daniel 5, one page over, verse 11. And this is when Nebuchadnezzar's son is there. And he says, there is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy Elohim. And in the days of your father, talking about Nebuchadnezzar, light and understanding and wisdom was found in him like the wisdom of the Elohim. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, appointed him chief of the Magi and the conjurers and the Chaldeans and the stargazing ones. So again, Daniel, you know, these Magi, they didn't just come from nowhere. They're not just these pagans that are up here doing, you know, whatever. They're getting this firsthand from Daniel. When Daniel was there, he's the chief of them. And as we're going to see when we look in some of these other scriptures, we're going to see that Daniel knew exactly what to look for. Because it was told to Daniel. What would be the sign of the Messiah? And through generation, after he died, he told them, and the Magi looked, and the Magi looked, and the Magi looked, until it was found. If we go to Daniel 9, we see how they even knew the time frame. In the days of Yeshua, not just Magi, but many people were in anticipation of the return of Messiah, just like today. Why is it today? Because the same things. We see the fig tree. Israel's a nation again. We see we're almost at the end of the 6,000 years. Do we know the day and the hour? No. The same as they didn't know the day and the hour, but they knew the general time frame that the Messiah was coming. How did they know? By this prophecy in Daniel 9. Daniel 9 and verse 24. 70 weeks, Shavuim is the word. 70 Shavuim, 70 sevens, are decreed to your people and as to your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make atonement for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know then and understand that from the issuing of the word to restore and rebuild Jerusalem to Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. 69 weeks, 483 years. It shall be built again with a plaza and trench even in times of affliction. We know in 457 BC, we know that King Xerxes gave this decree out to Nehemiah to go and rebuild Jerusalem. Not the temple, but the wall and the city around it. So they knew the general time frame that the Messiah was going to be born. They knew it. There's no doubt about it. The Bible clearly tells us in the 15th year of Tiberius, when Yeshua was roughly 30 years old, that he started his ministry. We know for a shadow of a doubt, those are two historic dates there that we know that was 27 AD, without a shadow of a doubt. If he started his ministry in 27 AD, the ministry was just about 3 years. We know the death was 30 AD. So we can pinpoint Yeshua's whole life. We can pinpoint then, if he's 30 years old, or when he starts his ministry in 27, then when would he be born? 3 BC. 3 BC. And we'll see, interesting enough, what happened in 3 BC. Let's go to Numbers 24. And let's look at one of the prophecies, how Daniel knew that there would be a star associated with the Messiah's birth. Numbers 24. Numbers 24 in verse 17. It says, I shall see him, but not now. This is when Balaam, remember when Balaam was told by Balak to go and curse Israel? And he couldn't curse him because Yahweh gave the blessing in there. And then he gives the blessing. He says, I shall see him, but not now. I shall behold him, but not near. A star leads forth out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall dash the corners of Moab, and shall break down all the sons of turmoil. And from the beginning, from ancient times, all rabbis always knew this was messianic. There's nothing ever written in the Talmud or the Mishnah or any other writings that would make us think anything but that this is messianic, talking about the Messiah. So we see that a certain star is going to bring, what's the scepter? The scepter is kingship. That there would be a star associated with the King Messiah. And Daniel knew it. And like I said, Daniel knew the prophecy. I mean, Yeshua appeared to Daniel. Gabriel appeared to Daniel. You know, we see it all in the book of Daniel. So he clearly knew it, and he handed it down from generation to generation. We go to Genesis 49. We see another interesting prophecy that comes up. Genesis 49. In verse 9. He says, Judah is a lion's whelp. You know, we all know the Lion of Judah, right? You know, Jerusalem, that's actually the symbol. My friend from the Philippines, Grace Cupana, made the largest flag in the world. This flag is like the size of two or three soccer fields. They needed hundreds of people to take this thing out. And I was honored that I was asked to go there and be a keynote speaker when they brought it. But she made it of the Lion of Judah for Jerusalem, for Yeshua. Because we know in Revelation it talks about. But there's not a lot that talks about. It's talked about here in Genesis, and it's talked about in Revelation. That Yeshua is the Lion of Judah. But yet, we know that Judah is associated with a lion, with the constellation of the lion. And we know from the Maseroth that that is the constellation of the lion is the symbol of Judah. That's their consolation. Judah, he says, Judah is a lion's whelp. My son, you have risen up from the prey. He stoops, he crouches like a lion, and like a lioness, who can arouse him? The scepter, so here's the king, right, shall not depart from Judah, nor the lawmaker from between his feet until he comes to whom it belongs, Shiloh, and the obedience of the people to him. Clearly messianic. Now, very interesting. What does he mean that the lawmaker, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the lawmaker from between his feet until he comes to whom it belongs? If you look at the constellation of the lion, in the feet of the lion is the brightest star that's in the heavens. And what's the name of it? Regulus. Do you know the word for between his feet in Hebrew? Regal. Regal. Regulus. It's the same word. So literally he's saying here that a lawmaker, nor will the lawmaker regal Regulus from between his feet. So we see there's a prophecy of the star, and then we see the prophecy of the lion with Regulus between his feet. When we look at the constellation of the lion, that's exactly what you're seeing there. So we clearly see now it's starting to come together. You have Venus, the morning star, representing Messiah. We have Jupiter, the king's planet. And you have Regulus, the brightest star that's in the sky. And those three luminary bodies together is what made up the star of Bethlehem. Jupiter being the main one. But when they came in constellation, and they would almost come together where you couldn't tell the difference, it would look like one big bright star in the sky. Now, the other thing before I read to you from the dates that these conjunctions came together, I just want to show to you this many people miss. When the Magi came, it was not the same time that Yeshua was born. You could clearly prove that from the Bible. When Yeshua was born, the shepherds were in the field. Yeshua was born in a cave. They came and he's lying in a manger. It's not like the little Christmas picture with the baby like that. A manger is a little trough that's cut out of stone. And it looks very much like a Jewish grave. And that's why it said they took the babe, they wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger. Exactly what they do when a Jewish person dies. So what is Luke telling us? He was born to die. Every single word has meaning. He was born to die. So when the Magi come, though, number one, he's not an infant anymore. The word is totally different. He's called a toddler. He's 6 or 7 months old. So it's 6 or 7 months after Yeshua was born that they're coming. And he's in the house. Here he's born in a cave in a manger. But when they come, he's in the house. So let's read it. Let's go to Matthew 2. Matthew 2 and verse 7. It says, then secretly calling the Magi, Herod asked them exactly the time of the start of the appearing. Exactly the time that these things started to happen, Herod wanted to know. Go down to verse 11. And having come into the house, they saw the child. Not infant anymore, but toddler, with his mother Miriam. And falling down, they worshipped him. And opening their treasures, they presented gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Verse 16, then seeing that he was mocked by the Magi, Herod was greatly enraged, and having sent, he killed the boys in Bethlehem and all the districts from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he exactly asked the Magi. See, according to the sign, they didn't know if the sign was at his conception or the sign was at his birth. So Herod played it safe. Yeshua was probably 7, 8 months old, and he killed all the children 2 years and under. But it gives us the time frame that we know when these things started to appear, and exactly when it happened. We know when he was born, it had to be 3 BC, 2 BC in that time frame. So now with modern technology, it's easy. All you have to do now is go, and you can do it yourself. Get a program, Story Night, or one of these things. Put in the dates I'm going to give you, and see if you don't see exactly what I'm going to read to you now. And it's exciting to see it. So let me read here from about 18 months of these amazing signs in the heavens that happened. Starting with August 12, 3 BC, this is about a month before Yeshua was born, Jupiter and Venus appeared together in a pre-dawn conjunction, which was even closer, just 0.7 degrees from each other is viewed from the Earth. Through the planets at this conjunction did not appear to touch one another, as they did some 10 months later on June 17th, which was the big one to get the Magi to come to the east. They were very close in the meeting. Then look what happened. What began as a pre-dawn morning star union on August 12th for Jupiter and Venus developed into their evening star reunion some 10 months later. There's more. The morning star conjunction of Jupiter and Venus on August 12th, 3 BC occurred when the planets were in the last degree of Cancer, which was the concluding sign of the Maseroth for the year. And yet at the evening star, the conjunction of the same planets came into their reunion 10 months later, happened in the first degree of the Lion, the beginning of the sign of the astronomical year. The 0 degree line for beginning astronomical calculations was between the signs of Cancer and Leo. So it was like one period was ending, another period was beginning. There's even more significant events that happened from 3 BC to 2 BC. Just 33 days after Jupiter and Venus, the morning star conjunction on August 12th, an observer would have seen Jupiter in union with Regulus. This would have been the star that the shepherds would have seen in the field. Regulus is the chief star in the constellation of the Lion of Judah. And because it lay practically on the path of the sun, it was reckoned as a royal star. Jupiter and Regulus came into juxtaposition on September 14, 3 BC. As viewed from the Earth, they were only 0.33 degrees from each other. Here's the king's planet, Jupiter, now coming in contact with the king's star, Regulus, in the royal constellation of the Lion of Judah. So all this happening, that they know something very, very interesting was going on here. So from that time, we see from that 18-month period or 15-month period, if you look at from 3 BC, from August 3 BC to December 2 BC, the conjunction of Jupiter and Venus that first happens on August 12th. Then you see September 14th, the major conjunction that happens between Jupiter with Regulus at just 0.33 degrees. Looked as one bright star, what the shepherds would have seen. And then Jupiter moves and retrogresses and comes in conjunction with Regulus again February 17th of the following year. And then on May 8th of the following year. So actually, what Jupiter did, and they all followed it. Even if you look at Arbabano, the ancient rabbi, he talks about, you know, for them to look when the Messiah comes for Jupiter. Jupiter actually retrogressed and came three times around the top of Regulus and crowned it. And crowned it, can you imagine? And that's why when the third time happened, that was June 17th, when the Magi said, "This is it! They're waiting for the king!" And they're seeing this happen, and they said, "Wow, how could this planet move this way?" So it comes once, it goes back, it comes once, and three times, it literally crowns Regulus in the constellation of the Lion of Judah. I'll show you here. I'll pass it around. Jacob, if you could get this on film here, as each one, and then pass it. That was something what the star of Bethlehem would have looked like. Something like the star of Bethlehem would have looked like. If you could first show it on the... and then you could pass it. Yeah, as long as it gets on film, then you could pass it around that you could look at. But we want to look a little closer, because this is just something that you would see with the naked eye. I have here, you could pass them. I have here, that's August 12th, what I talked about. This is exactly what it would have looked like. Venus and Jupiter, that would have been in the constellation of the Lion of Judah, right above Regulus. This was August 12th, 3 BC. Looking at the conjunction, if you can get that on film and then pass it around. This is a little closer look of the same one. Get that in there and then pass it. This is the one from right after Yeshua's birth with Jupiter and Regulus. And this is the last one that happened on June 17th. This is the one that would have had the Magi coming from the east, coming that way. So astonishing. Astonishing. When you look at this, you know, that what if they knew what to look for, you're seeing things that are just amazing to people that watch this. They're seeing things they never saw in their life that was showing them that the King, the Messiah, is born. But there's even more. There's even more that something happened that we can pinpoint Yeshua's birth to within 2 hours. Go to Revelation 12. Revelation 12. And a great sign was seen in the heavens. Is that what we're looking for? Signs in the heavens, right? A woman having been clothed with the sun, and the moon was under her feet, and on a crown, and on her head was a crown of 12 stars. Betula, the virgin, which is right next to the constellation of the lion. And you could look, if you have a telescope, you could look literally, Betula, the constellation of the Virgin, has 12 stars around her head. I want to show you here. In 3 BC, September 11th, interesting date, right? Especially us as Americans. September 11th, 3 BC, only between 6:15 and 8 o'clock at night, exactly that happened. Check it out for yourself. I'll pass it around. Please put that on the film and pass it. 3 BC, between 6:15 and 8:15 at night, on the Feast of Trumpets. That was the Feast of Trumpets that year. Rosh Hashanah. When do you blow a trumpet? You blow a trumpet to announce war, and you blow a trumpet to announce a king. 3 BC, exactly at that time, was the only time that the moon was in midsection of the Virgin, or the sun was in midsection, the moon right under her feet. Now, another thing that's interesting, look at the next verse. And having a babe in the womb, she cried, being in labor and having birth pains to deliver. And another sign was seen in the heavens, and behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads were 7 crowns. And he threw his tail in a third of the stars of heaven, and he threw them to the earth, and the dragon stood before the woman about to bear, so that when she bears, he might devour a child. What did Herod do, right? To kill the male children. There's a constellation at the top of the northern part that covers a third of the stars. It's called Draco, the dragon. Take a look, put that on. Here's a more animated look at it. But when that happened, when Yeshua was born, and the Virgin was birthed that way, that's exactly what was happening. That Drago was having a, the whatever they call it, when the stars are, was shooting out of it. And here is the Virgin. Orion is right there, who is symbolic of Michael. You know, if you look from ancient writings, they always say the constellation of Orion is symbolic of Michael, the archangel. And there's the dragon trying to devour the male child that the woman's just about ready to have. Amazing. Can you imagine that from the beginning of time, Yahweh has all this in the heavens and it can't be manipulated. And like I said, we're living in a time that any of you can go out and check this out for yourself. Just get a program, you know, get a constellation program, put in a date, and you'll see exactly what the sky looked like. And I've done your homework for you. I made the copies so that you can see it. Now, why is this important? Why is this important? Because in the end time, once again, Yeshua told us to watch. And what did he tell us? To watch the signs in the heavens. To watch the signs in the heavens. Interesting enough, last year in December of 2010, a comet came into our galaxy called Elenin. I don't know if anybody ever heard of it. There was a lot on the internet last year that there was supposed to be all this trouble that comes from it because it might be close enough to the Earth to cause all this trouble, which it didn't. But I don't believe that was the cause of it. Because, do you know the word Elenin? It was named after a Russian scientist or something. But Elenin is a very interesting meaning in Hebrew. It means the gavel of Yahweh. or the hammer of Yahweh. And this last year, right at Rosh Hashanah, it comes into our galaxy, goes through the constellation of the Virgin, and the morning star is following her. The morning star is following this comet. And for the last year, and it isn't ended yet, August 4th, some things are going to happen with this Elenin going into August 17th, but it's going to disappear out of our galaxy August 17th. Now, what's interesting about it is most comets go in rotation, like Halley's Comet. It comes every so many years. This comet is a one-time thing. That's it. First time it's ever here, and it will never be here again. And this comet, I believe, was setting up because there are signs in the heavens that are coming. This Sukkot. They're starting on Rosh Hashanah, going through Sukkot, that are very similar to what we went over today at the Star of Bethlehem. And I believe there's one particular sign that I still have some investigation to do, so I can't announce it to you today, but I will fairly shortly. One particular sign that has not happened in more than 2,000 years that will clearly show the bridegroom is ready to come out of his chamber. So again, you can't make this up. Either it's there or it's not. Either they're moving this way or they're not. But Yahweh clearly gave us. He gave us the Maseroth. He gave us the signs in the heavens. He gave us these things to prepare. To prepare. To prepare for his coming. To prepare for his kingdom. To get ready for it. And like I said, to the skeptic, they're going to be, they say in the book of Peter, they'll be saying, they've been saying this since the fathers fell asleep. You know, where's the promise of his coming? And that's why they'll be eating and drinking and marrying till the end. But to the wise, to the ones that are looking for the signs in the heavens, you will not be taken by surprise. You will not be taken without knowing what's going on. There are amazing signs in the heavens, like I said, that are coming at this point, that are going to show some very interesting things. Last scripture, Luke 21, 28. But when you see these things begin to happen, have courage and lift your heads, because your salvation draws near. Praise Yahweh. Today I come to tell you our salvation is drawing near. So we are going to take a little break. We have some food. Please be with us. And then we'll come and we'll do some questions and answers for a while. As long as you want to stay, I'll stay. And whatever questions you have, I'll try the best I can to answer. So Yahweh bless. And we'll see everybody maybe in 20, 30 minutes, you know, back here. Thank you. Yeah.